This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Broadcasting from the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Hoho Loon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia, Greg Phillips and Nick Duke are the hard-traveling fanboys.
Hard-traveling fanboys, hard-traveling fanboys.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the longest running
weekly episodic comic book podcast in all Place to Be Nation.
We are coming to you live, on tape delay, of course, from the L-shaped studio in Hoho Loon Plaza in beautiful, serene Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. I am Greg Phillips. He is Nick Duke. We are the hard traveling fanboys. Nick, how is you?
I'm doing pretty good. I got a Skype friend request from somebody named Peachy Vicious, so I'm pretty sure I should accept that, right?
I think that sounds saucy.
It can't be nefarious in any way, I wouldn't think.
No, not nefarious. Definitely not nefarious.
Not at all.
Yes, so we are on another excursion today, because this is an episode of The Long Book Hunters, where Nick and I take a look at a trade paperback or graphic novel, and in this case, we are doing this to kick off Black Panther Month here at the HTF Studios. Black Panther, of course, from Marvel Studios will be out later this month, and we will have an exclusive review of that for your ears, and we're going to kick things off here with a little bit of a disclaimer. Nick and I really don't have much of a working knowledge of Black Panther as a solo character. I think I speak for Nick in saying that we have never read a Black Panther solo comic until this week for this project. Go ahead, Nick.
I read a couple of random solo tie-in issues to Civil War and various Marvel events over the years. But nothing in terms of an actual storyline, you know, usually just little bits and pieces here and there that weren't really necessary, you know. The classic tie-in that's branded as a tie-in, even though it has no real relevance to the plot of the main event that's going on. So, yeah, I would agree with that. Not really knowledgeable at all about Black Panther. So this was something of an experiment and something I was looking forward to. And I got to say, I walked away pretty impressed.
Yes, same here. You see, when I was a kid and I was really into Marvel Comics, I was reading the X-Men side of things, the Spider-Man side of things, and the cosmic side of things. And so I never encountered Black Panther, who was largely contained in the Avengers books. Didn't really have a solo title that I'm aware of throughout the 80s and early 90s. And then in 1998, along came a guy named Christopher Priest, formerly named Jim Owsley, who kind of was handed the reins of this character and rebuilt him from the ground up. And that's what we're here to review this week, is this first collection of this 1998 through, I think, 2003 Christopher Priest run on Black Panther. It's called Black Panther, The Client. And it features the writing, of course, of Christopher Priest, who you may know as the current writer of Deathstroke for DC. He's also, when he was known as Jim Owsley, was a writer and an editor on the Green Lantern books back in the 80s, has done just a litany of well-respected, well-received books over the years. But it's also got the art from, the art in this series, actually, it gets split up a little bit. There's a guest artist in the last issue, but most of this story is told by artist and former Atlanta Braves and New York Yankees first baseman Mark Teixeira, which I thought was very interesting. Nick,
Indeed it is. Always good to see Big Tex back out there doing things. And, you know, it's one of the few, probably one of the few guys that we can find some common ground on with our Place to Be Nation cohorts.
Exactly, exactly. He spent some time in both locales and provided good service. And here, his pencils have never looked better, in my opinion. I was stunned by his ability to swing the old pencil as well as he does the bat. But nonetheless, this story kind of drops you in. And the interesting thing about it is you can make the argument that the lead character in this story is not even the Black Panther.
That's a good point. You really could make that argument.
This government agent who we meet, Nick, is that fair to say that Ross is kind of the main character here?
Yeah, it seems like, you know, he's kind of the character that's really telling the story, the point of view character, so to speak. But even though I would argue that the Black Panther is the one driving most of the plot and driving the action forward, it's kind of like you have co-leads here, which is interesting because, to my knowledge, I believe Everett Ross was an original creation of Priest when he wrote this book. So it's interesting to have, you know, a Black Panther co-starring in a book with a brand new white character right off the bat.
Yes, Everett K. Ross is his name, and his first appearance was in Kazar, of all things, number 17, written by Christopher Priest in September of 98, which is the same month that this book dropped, I believe. So you get, and this is part of the Marvel Knights line of comics, which we have reviewed before with Garth Ennis's Punisher, Welcome Home, Frank, as well as with the Kevin Smith, Joe Quesada Daredevil, they kind of kicked off the line. So pretty interesting here as we're dropped into this Marvel Knights universe here with Black Panther by Christopher Priest. And Everett Ross here is the kind of the kiddie pride of Black Panther, if you will. We see it through his eyes, the story through his eyes. And it gives the reader kind of a crash course in who Black Panther is, who T'Challa is, who T'Chaka was, what Wakanda is, and pretty much the entire, in the course of five issues, you get the origin of Black Panther, you get to see how he came to be an Avenger, and you get to see how he carries himself today. And obviously this is taking place well into his career as an Avenger and a superhero and the king of Wakanda, but we get flashbacks pretty cleverly done, and Priest introduces here a tactic that he uses to this day on Deathstroke, which is this kind of non-linear, almost Quentin Tarantino-like storytelling style, Nick.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And I think at one point they even like have in some of the subtitles Tarantino in big white and black letters written on the page. Mm-hmm. So it's very clear that that influence is something that Priest is not afraid to wear on his sleeve when it comes to this book. And you mentioned, you know, you kind of get the crash course into, you know, who T'Challa is and who T'Chaka is. But the thing I guess I was most impressed by was fleshing out his supporting cast, introducing us to characters like, I believe his name was Zuri.
Zuri.
Zuri, yeah. And the Dora Milaje, who were both awesome characters as well. So you had a really cool, you know, a rapid expansion of the supporting cast that's kind of meant to get you knee deep in the Black Panther mythology fairly early on to the series.
Yes, and thankfully, now I'm not going to be able to recite it here because I don't have the book right in front of me, but what the series also does is it gives you pronunciations of some of these terms that are thrown in, which a lot of times comics will introduce kind of either foreign or out there terms or words, and they don't really tell you how to pronounce them, and they kind of leave you on your own merits. Well, here we get helpful pronunciation guides when you get something like the Adora Milaje that comes along, and you know, it's very helpful, and it's a very cool way to me of kicking off a run, because this isn't a reboot of Black Panther. This is not a reimagining of the character or a de-aging of him or anything like that. This is being handed a character that they haven't done much with for years, but that's been around, and basically you have to come up with a way to introduce him to a new audience and give him some agency in a modern era. Now, this is 1998 modern, but but it was very modern for the time. And so the way that they go about tackling this, they drop T'Challa off in New York City on a mission to find whoever killed a girl that his foundation was associated with. One of the girls that was linked to his foundation has come up murdered. His foundation has been disgraced by an embezzling scandal, and T'Challa leaves Wakanda to come and take care of this. And in the meantime, now he's having to pretty much fight a war on two fronts, as Wakanda is being overcome by his enemy, Akebi. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. Actually, I can't remember. Akebi, or Achebi, I guess it would be his name, who is his nemesis, has seized Wakanda while he's been gone, and he's also trying to figure out who killed this girl. So there's a nice mystery element to it that kicks that off, but primarily by telling this mystery, the mystery is not really as important to the story as the characters and introducing who they are, what drives them, what motivates them. And I guess the best place to start would be with T'Challa himself. And we get a version of T'Challa that is very recognizable in some ways to the version that we got in the movies. The movie version, of course, is much younger than this T'Challa. But nevertheless, we see bits and pieces of young T'Challa through flashbacks. And we also see current T'Challa. And it's very much that noble African king that we've gotten on the big screen. So if you enjoyed Black Panther and Civil War, I think that you'll pretty well identify with what you see here on the comic book page. He's confident. He's noble. He's very wise. He makes the right decisions, but he does have buttons that can be pressed. And the villains of this story press those buttons throughout and presumably going forward.
Yeah, I mean, he has some similarities to the brief glimpse of Black Panther we've gotten in the MCU thus far. But one thing that I was kind of struck by was the way he was depicted here in terms of the art. A much larger and more physically imposing figure than I've typically thought of the Black Panther as being. I've always thought of the Black Panther as kind of being someone who uses speed and agility and, you know, stealth to accomplish a lot of things. Not saying that he's not a hand-to-hand expert, which he certainly is, but it almost seemed to me like this Black Panther is also equally adept at just brute strength. There are times where he just brutalizes guys, and it's pretty damn awesome to behold. But you know, like you said, this kind of delves right into that central idea behind Black Panther, in that he's both a hero and a political figurehead. That's an idea that's been explored in various other comics characters, such as Namor and Aquaman. But here, it's almost like it works a little bit better, just because you don't have that physical separation between land and water. You know, you kind of got him. You know, Wakanda's not a real country, but the climate and the setting of Africa is one that I think we're a bit more familiar with and isn't quite as fantastical as something like Atlantis. And it makes it feel a little bit more grounded. And I really dug that entire setup.
Absolutely. And you mentioned grounded because it is a Marvel Knights series. So it is intense at times, although I didn't notice much in the way of profanity per se. And I didn't notice much in the way of just obscene violence, the way that we saw in, say, The Punisher. But what I did notice is a much more grounded version of the Marvel Universe than what you might be used to. The way that the street thugs talk was very realistic and contemporary for the time, and the environment as well. It was the difference to me of reading a Marvel comic in that era of, say, Captain America or the Avengers, and then reading this. Would I assume be similar to going to the big screen and watching the Avengers and then going home and watching Daredevil on Netflix or Luke Cage on Netflix. Mm-hmm. It very much comes off to me as a Netflix type series, complete with very low stakes action for the most part, for most of the series. You get, you know, street level thugs, you get one-on-one encounters, you get very personal situations. You get entire stretches of time focusing on a guy sitting on a couch next to the devil himself.
Yeah, it's one thing I was going to say, you know, for us talking about it feeling grounded, it also features the literal devil for an extended period of time. So there's
absolutely, you know, and that touches on a weird thing to say. Something that to me helps this book a lot, because one of the things that kind of intimidated me about Black Panther back in the 2000s when I was getting back into comics was sometimes in comic books especially, the African royalty storyline, or not just African, but any kind of foreign royalty storyline can tend to be boring because they take themselves so seriously. And you've got this comic book bombastic dialogue and ridiculous situations that you're being asked to take ultra seriously. And sometimes it can get to be a bit hokey. Well, Christopher Priest, as he does on Deathstroke, and as he has done on Justice League as well, what he does is he takes this serious situation, and he doesn't undermine it. He keeps the drama, he keeps the grit, he keeps the street levelness that we talked about a moment ago, but what he adds to it is humor, a lot of humor, and not misplaced humor, but humor that just, hard to describe, but it works for the story. And a lot of that is due to the art of Teixeira and the way that he draws these scenes, because some of these panel layouts are just brilliant for the patience in the storytelling, the economy of the storytelling. And it's something that I have to believe comes from Priest's scripts, because we see it today as well.
Yeah, I mean, he does a phenomenal job. He's able to walk that line between humor and drama better than just about any modern comic writer that I've come across. And I'm not nearly as well versed in Chris Priest stuff as you are, but what little I've read, I can definitely say that he has that ability. So, you know, I don't really know what else to say about that. I did think the art was really distinctive, and I thought it was. Mm-hmm. I couldn't tell. There were times where I couldn't tell if I liked it or not, and yet there would be times where I just absolutely loved it. I found myself kind of jumping all around the board with it, depending on what was going on at any given moment.
Yeah, same here. There were certain scenes where it was hard. There were a couple scenes where it was a little hard to tell, you know, the framing of the characters and stuff like that for some of the action scenes. I think the action scenes maybe at times weren't as good as some of the just on their own scenes, for lack of a better term. The more slowed down scenes were better, where it was just characters interacting. But I thought it was distinctive, and I thought it fit the tone of this book. It made it feel different. It made it feel not like a typical superhero book. Although certainly there are times with the musculatures and the hulking figures where it does feel like a 90s superhero comic. Most of the time, it feels more like a 90s Vertigo comic, if that makes sense, in terms of the way the characters are drawn, the way that their facial expressions are. And it, like you said, it's a little all over the place, because there's, you know, the a Chebi character, his face is drawn so cartoonish, you know, almost like the way that some of the X-Men artists back in the 80s, Mark Silvestri, would draw some characters. But yet T'Challa is drawn very realistic, and Ross, Everett Ross, is drawn extremely realistic. And I think Ross is also where much of the humor of this story comes from. We were talking the other day on the phone, Nick, about how we hope that the movie version of Everett Ross is as funny as the comic version is, because he provides just some great lines throughout this as we're getting his report to his boss about what he's encountered in his dealings with T'Challa in the last few days. So just a lot of humorous references to things. You know, there's a line about it being Ulysses Klaue's men being like the Backstreet Boys surrounded by the Wu-Tang Clan. there's just a lot of really great lines throughout this.
Yeah, there really are. I know Martin Freeman played him very briefly in Captain America: Civil War, and we didn't really get to see any of this personality that we see here in the comic come through in that. So here's hoping there's an expansion of that. But yeah, a lot of great moments, whether it's him sitting on the couch with Mephisto, or him trying to shoot a rat while wearing no pants, or him busting out a little naked banjo. I mean, there's a lot of great moments for him in this book.
Naked banjo. Now, Nick, how many times have you played naked banjo?
At least twice.
You know, I knew what the answer would be before I even asked it. But I think that's something that our listeners may want to to keep in mind if we ever switch to a video podcast format.
Well, all I'm saying is at least twice.
But yes, it was a really good job of that. Now, Nick mentioned Mephisto. We referenced earlier the devil himself. Mephisto is now, Nick, you're a little more versed in modern Marvel than I am, but Mephisto is basically the Marvel version of Satan.
Essentially, yes. Although they introduced some concepts here that I wasn't aware of that make him seem... I don't know what exactly he is, Greg, but let's just call him Satan and move on.
He's a ruler of Hades. Some folks call it hell, I call it Hades.
I knew there would be a return of Carl Childers in tonight's episode. I just knew it.
Reckon you said there'd be more earlier and there wasn't.
Or perhaps you had your memory jogged by a certain Facebook account. Who can really say?
That's for me to decide, quite frankly, and for the audience to shut up and take. So Mephisto and Black Panther, that was one thing that kind of threw me, because I'm like, man, Black Panther versus Mephisto, that seems rather one-sided, doesn't it? But the way that it plays out in the book actually makes a lot of sense, by comic book standards anyway, and is actually leads to a really fun example of... kind of similar to the ending of the Doctor Strange movie, where he has to outsmart this impossibly powerful mystical figure. Here, T'Challa ends up, I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but basically the only way that he can beat Mephisto is by outsmarting him, and that's exactly what happens.
Yeah, it was also kind of a what the fuck moment when he just walked into the apartment, walked straight up to Mephisto and cold cocked him in the face and knocked him
yes.
out. I was not exactly expecting that confrontation to begin that way, but that's exactly how it began. And then you kind of got these two facing off on a more mental and emotional plane as opposed to a physical plane. And like Greg said, we don't want to spoil exactly how it plays out. That's right, we don't want to spoil a book that's nearly 20 years old at this point, but suffice it to say that you know, we get to see a pretty good snapshot of how T'Challa is more than just brawn and athleticism. He's got a pretty good a lot of brains and a very good support structure behind him as well,
and one tight ass. It raises an excellent question, though, Nick, or what I think is an excellent question. Who am I to say, really? But the question that it raises is, where the hell was T'Challa when Peter Parker was making his deal with Mephisto years later?
Yeah, who knows? Who knows where he was?
I mean, why couldn't he just walk up and knock Mephisto on his ass and spare us the entire One More Day fiasco?
I guess he was too busy getting up in that storm ass at that point, because that was kind of his deal at that point. And who can blame him, really? He was too busy for Peter Parker's affairs.
I know what he was busy doing.
Yes?
He was busy strutting that ass.
Strutting that ass. There that is.
I believe that Black Panther ended up in Gunnersville at some point in the late 2000s.
Now... you know, that would be very interesting, because I don't think people in Gunnersville take too likely to his kind.
That's not for us to say. That's for the fine folks of Gunnersville to decide, I suppose.
We just lost our massive Gunnersville audience, thanks to me. Oh, damn.
Yeah, do you know what I'm going to have to do, Nick, much to your chagrin, to make up for losing the Gunnersville listeners? I'm going to have to go after our New Zealand listeners again at some point.
I thought you were going to say you were going to lift your self-imposed boycott of Daleville and make a play for Daleville listeners.
Never. I'm going to go back to New Zealand, and you won't know when it's coming, Nick, but rest assured, the Kiwi will return to the hard-traveling fanboys.
Well, that'll be appropriate given that Danny McBride Dundee trailer that's floating around out there.
Which apparently is I don't want to ruin the illusion for anybody out there, but there's a lot. I will say this, the cast is incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. Certain members of the cast are certainly incredible.
By that, you mean?
Certain members.
Russell Crowe, right?
Certain golden haired, muscly bearded members that may or may not be in the Avengers movies.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Margot Robbie at first, but the bearded threw me off. But in any event, we're not here to talk. Hey, you haven't lived until you've made out with a bearded woman before. But we're not here to talk about all that. We're here to talk about Black Panther. And it's an exciting time in the fandom right now because a lot of people who have loved Black Panther for many years are gonna be able to finally show people what they love about the character. But for those of us who don't know much about Black Panther, have only encountered him, my primary exposure to him has been through the video games, Marvel Ultimate Alliance and Ultimate Alliance 2.
Where he is a badass, by the way.
Absolutely, and one of the best characters to pick. But for people like us, this is a great crash course book. I actually don't think they could have done any better on this. I think it was telling that this came out at such a kind of a down time for Marvel and for the industry in general, but its longevity shows just how important it was and how it found an audience. And it's no secret reading this why it found an audience, Nick. The great characters across the board, from the supporting cast that you mentioned to the villains of the piece, with a great twist at the end that I did not see coming. Just a handling of the timelines and how to work in an origin organically while dropping you in to a hero's present day, which is something a lot of stories could learn from. It's very much a masterclass of storytelling. Not the greatest. The art will not be for everybody, but I ended up really liking it. I thought the art fit the story very well. And the only thing I'll say that was jarring is when there's the guest artist that fills in.
Yes.
I swear that changed things up. And as particularly with regards to that detective that they keep encountering, Torque.
It made him look like Thor.
Yeah. He went from in the first issue, he looked, you know, like he may have been, I don't know, Mexican or something. And then a couple of issues later, he looks like he's a white guy, but he's, you know, got dark hair. And then when he shows up in the last issue, like you said, he looks like Thor. He's got blonde hair. And he's all big and muscly and like the muscly arm paper boy and whatnot. It was off-putting a little bit. The shift in art. Not that either art style was better or worse. I don't know how he was supposed to be drawn, but it was just jarring the change there.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But I mean, outside of that shakeup in artist for the one issue, I got to say, I pretty much very difficult to think of anything to overly criticize here. You know, was the main art from Teixeira the greatest in the world? No, but it was pretty good for most of it. And Chris Priest just, you know, wrote and plotted the hell out of this thing. So I got to say, big thumbs up for me. Actually, makes me want to eventually read more of this, even though I know I probably won't, given my massive backlog of comics I need to be reading that I'm buying every week.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is I don't know if this is actually still in print. They may be reprinting the Chris Priest run.
He's actually supposed to be getting an omnibus of this run.
Oh, awesome. Awesome. Well, you can find this book used on Amazon and possibly at your local comic book shop or just an older version of it. But I would definitely recommend it, Nick. I would recommend buying this one. Would you?
Yeah, absolutely. If you can find a reasonably priced, first trade, which covers the first five issues 1 through 5 of what I believe wound up being a 60 issue run for Priest, by all means, go right ahead. And while we haven't read the other ones, I have to imagine, knowing what we know about the guy and knowing how revered this run is, if you see an opportunity to get some of those older trades, you know, pick them up. It's certainly not going to get cheaper to do that. Well, with the movie coming out, but like I said, you know, I'm pretty sure Marvel is going to be seeking to capitalize off the almost assured massive financial success of the film, and I would be stunned if we didn't see some reprints of this run on our comic shelves in the near future.
Absolutely. And while I haven't read enough to say for sure on the omnibus, I would assume the omnibus would be a good investment if you can get your hands on it. Or you can get Marvel Unlimited, and the entire run appears to be on Marvel Unlimited.
And it is, so, yes.
So just, again, high recommendation here. Have you read this book? If so, let us know your thoughts on social media. I am at gphillips8652 on Twitter. Nick is at nickduke87 on Twitter. You can send us emails, gregp@placetobenation.com, nickd@placetobenation.com, or you can go to Facebook, type in Place to Be Nation Comics in your search bar, and join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. Join the discussion, folks. You never know what topics could be brought up at a given time. Aunt May's nethers, you never know. I mean, but nonetheless, we hope you stick with us through the break. We're going to take a commercial, allow some of our friends at the wrestling side, as well as our buddies here at Place to Be Nation Pop, such as Sellers Points, Conversation Comics, Geek and Sassy, Sunday Groove, etc., to get their ads in. And on the other side, we'll have a loaded read and watch it and the rundown. Stay with us.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories Podcast.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes, and while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
And that's when I said, "Bear, it looked like a hornet to me." oh, Oh, welcome back, folks. We are still live here in the studio. And
we have to apologize for making a massive error in the first half of the show. Right before we went to break, I know you heard my colleague running down the list of other Place to Be Nation pop shows, and he said there was a show, something called Sunday Groove, of which I am not familiar with. The show, of course, is titled Easy Like David Sunday. Easy Like David Sunday. Didn't want to confuse anybody out there, so our apologies on that one.
Easy like David Sunday. It does work, doesn't it?
It really does. And think about the awesome, you know, theme song that the manager Todd Weber probably could have recorded for it. But you know,
well, I understand that the manager Todd Weber has connections out on the West Coast, including connections with one Lionel Richie. Now, we are back, of course, because we got to get to all of our weekly recurring stuff here. And, well, let's just go right out of the gates with the longest-running weekly episodic segment in all of Place to Be Nation pop. And that is Reading and Watching.
Reading and Watching. What you been reading and watching?
What have you been reading and watching? Tell us!
Now, Nick, I understand you've been reading some stuff, so I'm going to...
No, I read the one thing. I just read the one thing. I read one book last week, and that book was Doomsday Clock Number 3. I don't want to comment too much because I know we got a lot of people who listen to the show. And by a lot of people, I mean a handful of people who listen to the show who are also reading Doomsday Clock. And I'm not sure that everybody is caught up. I don't believe you are, for example, Greg.
I'm not.
So suffice it to say, this is another outstanding installment in what is already becoming one of the best event books in comics in recent memory, put it that way. We finally get to see some Batman and some Rorschach facing off, various other characters that I didn't necessarily expect getting to encounter one another, and kind of an idea of where some of these new characters like Mime and Marionette are possibly heading in this story. So, very intriguing all around, and it just makes it's going to make the wait for issue 4 that much more painful now that we're moving to the every other month shipping schedule.
Excellent. There is no series that I am anticipating reading more than that, to the point that I'm actually going to skip all the backlog of books I have to make sure that I read Doomsday Clock first.
And you know, to be honest, I haven't really picked up on anything that seems like it was directly influenced by any of the goings on in the monthly book, so I don't think you're going to have an issue there.
Excellent. I've got boxes of unread comics right now that I have to get to, but Doomsday Clock is top on my list. Now let's move on to watching. So before we get into the weekly DC CW shows, you've been watching anything else, Nick, comic book related?
Not that I can think of.
Well, I have, and okay. I'm about to tell you why.
Okay.
I have watched not one, not two, but three additional episodes of Luke Cage.
Oh man, you're getting you're inching yourself ever closer to Iron Fist, which is what I'm most excited for.
I am on episode 10 now of Luke Cage, and I have to say, all of the warnings I was given about the shift after the there is a change in villain at a certain point in the season, and every bit of warning that I had gotten about the change in villain was correct, because Diamondback ain't got nothing on Cottonmouth as a villain. In fact, Diamondback,
or as an actor.
Or as an actor, no, or as a character or anything. Diamondback gives utterance to the single most ludicrous line that I have heard in the Marvel Netflix universe. And there have been some doozies, but none have even approached the sheer ridiculousness of, very seriously now, not as a joke, very seriously, I'll murderize all of them. Now, you might think to yourself, well, maybe he was just impersonating Mickey from the Rocky movies. He was not. Believe me, that was my first thought. And then I rewound it and watched it probably 700 times. And no, there is no Mickey there. He's just honestly saying he's going to murderize everyone. And it's supposed to be an intimidating line, indicated by the fact that all the other actors in the room sell it as an intimidating line. It is not an intimidating line, however. Diamondback sucks. He's just not interesting. I don't know why every comic book character has to have an evil family member that becomes a villain. Like, it, you know, it, at a certain point, all right, daddy issues, brother issues, everybody's got them, evidently. But nevertheless, that happens. I thought one of the episodes featured Misty Knight. I think it was the same episode, actually, featured Misty Knight for the very first time in the show, being really, just really I'm just going to say it, just being a bitch for no real reason. Particularly what offended me in this episode was Misty's treatment of Claire, who has been the most understanding and compassionate character in the entirety of the Netflix Marvel Universe. Claire has been there to support all of the characters in the shows. We've grown to respect and appreciate Claire, and there is cash built up there. And the one thing that you don't do is you don't yell at Claire, and you don't threaten Claire, and you don't slam Claire up against a wall, which is what Misty does in this episode. So, didn't like that. I continue to like Misty Knight as a character, though. I think the actress is very, very strong. I wasn't happy with that. So really bad stretch of episodes here for Luke. One bad episode and a couple of just kind of boring episodes. And the last one I watched was when they're trying to remove the shrapnel from Luke by dipping him in boiling acid.
Ah, yes. Because comics.
And didn't like that episode that much either. Very disappointed after what was an incredible first half of Luke Cage.
Yeah, I told you there was a drop off coming. My thing with Luke Cage is the first half of that show is so great that it makes up for the drop off and still winds up being, you know, well enough anyway to make the show overall still be a good show. It's just frustrating because it was on pace to be an all-time great show.
Right. And you look at its placement and its similarities to the other Netflix shows, and it's that, man, you just wish it could stick the landing, you know?
Yeah, I've talked about this a little bit before, but beginning with Daredevil Season 2 and pretty much every show they've done since then, Marvel has felt a bizarre need to swap villains halfway through those 13 episode seasons. Or I say that at least they did that with Daredevil Season 2, Luke Cage, and with Iron Fist. They didn't do it with Defenders, luckily. Well, actually, they kind of did. And it seems to be a weird narrative decision every time they make it, and I don't really understand why they're doing it. It's almost like they're trying to split the seasons into two separate halves. And if that's what you want to do, what is to prevent you from just releasing six episode seasons and not feeling the need to arbitrarily shift direction so wildly in the middle of a season?
With all that being said, it's time for us to get on to our CWDC shows. And we kicked off the week on Supergirl with the continued fight to stop Rain and her reign of terror over National City. So we pick up with Kara trying to uncover information, if you will, about Rain. And she learns that there is a Kryptonian sorceress or of some kind who was on Fort Roz that is now locked away. And you'll forgive me, Nick, you have to fill me in on why exactly she was in this location, this planet that had a blue star that would kind of take away Kara's abilities.
The implication, I think they said something like Kara threw the prison out into space, and I guess it just kind of floated along.
Gotcha.
I have no idea. I can't explain that. It did because reasons, Greg. Because of reasons. That's all that matters.
Nonetheless, Kara, of course, will, if she goes after this place to interrogate this priestess, will not have her powers. So she realizes she needs help. And that's where Saturn Girl?
Mm-hmm.
And
Livewire?
Yeah, and then Supergirl decides to recruit her old enemy, Livewire, who's working as a waitress in a cocktail bar. That much is true.
It's a breakfast place, but...
Whatever. I was doing a song lyric, you bastard.
Yes, an inaccurate song lyric, but anyway.
That's not inaccurate. I was working as a waitress at a cocktail bar. That's the line from Human League's Don't You Want Me, Baby.
Right. I'm saying that the lyric was inaccurate when applied in this context.
Oh, that doesn't matter.
Anyway, we're moving on.
As well as a fourth female villain who I don't remember the name of.
Now. Psy.
All right, now what's the name of the villain?
I see what you did there.
Anyway, she's abnormally hot, whoever she is.
Oh, I'm glad you said it. Woo!
Oh, my God.
Woo! You know, Greg, she's one of those girls that you want to take out to a nice dinner on the town and then take her home and pat her on the back respectfully like a gentleman.
And then say, thank you for the evening.
Thank you for the evening. It was lovely.
She is a delight. But nonetheless, so the four of them who all, you know, wacky tag team partners who hate each other. You know, we know how that goes. Kara has
issues with Saturn Girl.
Yep. You know, her and Livewire. Livewire and Psy don't like each other.
Yeah,
so,
for reasons undetermined.
This line has yet to be written. So it's wacky tag partners who hate each other. Vince Russo special, right?
Mm-hmm.
They go off.
Not just a Vince Russo special, kind of a WWE for the last 10 years or 15 years special.
Yes. And so they go off into space, the final frontier, and attempt to find this person. So meanwhile, back at the ranch... Samantha is her name, right? Drops her daughter, Ruby, off with Alex to be babysat while she, quote, goes out of town on a business trip, end quote. But in fact, she unwittingly becomes Rain and flies out into space to try and stop this priestess from giving away all their plans. In the process... meanwhile, Brainiac and Wynn have kind of a dick measuring contest as Brainiac is just constantly mocking all of the primitive technology of the DEO.
Do Kaluans even have dicks? How do they reproduce?
You know, that's a wonderful question. One that I'll have to refer to noted Superman expert. Insert name here, because I don't know any noted Superman experts. Mark Waid, I guess, would be the foremost Superman expert. Mm-hmm. Maybe he knows. I don't know. Maybe Jeff Johns knows. I don't know. I don't know how Kaluans repopulate. But in this case, he is not – he and Wynn are getting into it a little bit. And, of course, that subplot has a moment where Wynn gets to, you know, get one up on him a little bit. So, anyway, all this is going on in space. They are breaking into this fortress – and trying to get this information on Rain that could help them stop her. And it leads to some pretty good exchanges, I thought. Particularly, it shined a light, this episode did, on Kara. And I always like when episodes remind us of Kara's basic decency and her basic humanity and the fact that Kara's answer to all these problems is not punching, is not killing. It's trying to get through to these bad guys. You know, she gets through to Livewire in this episode in a way that was unexpected and kind of forges, you know, an unexpected connection with her in the course of their journey to make them realize they have more similarities than they thought. She also works to try to get through to Rain, which doesn't really work at all. But it's reminding you that Kara is always going to try to find the best way to solve a problem and not just try to destroy the problem, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely it does, you know. And it kind of developed some of these other side characters, you know. Livewire and Psy both had kind of been played as pretty one note for the most part in their previous appearances, and so it was kind of cool to see the show kind of take an opportunity to develop some of these villains of the week who often don't have the most complex motivations. So really appreciated that as well. And honestly, pretty much all the stuff going on with Kara and out in space was really good. I wasn't as fond of the Wynn and Brainiac stuff, but it was fine. But I found myself just wanting them to get through it and get back to Fort Roz pretty much every time they would cut away. So
I agree. I thought all of the Fort Roz stuff was great. Was very good. And was entertaining, and the fight with Rain at the end was really good. I thought the effects were good. I think Livewire is a character where the effects were able to for me anyway, to look a little bit better than they have in some of the other appearances. And they've always done a decent job with Livewire. So I thought that was good, the fight with Rain. The sacrifice of Livewire was cool. I'm still not sure that Livewire is the strongest actress in the world. But she was good enough to get the job done with that, and ultimately left with a good episode. And again, one of the highlights of the episode was Rain and the continued complexity of that character, particularly at the end now, where it looks like Samantha might be realizing that something is going on, something's up, and needs to be addressed. So hopefully that'll be coming around the bend pretty soon.
Yeah, I would hope so as well. I think that would go a long way to easing some of my concerns I've had about the character of Rain, and that I haven't really been overly impressed by the dual personality take on the character. And I think there's much more interesting material to be mined by Samantha feeling genuinely conflicted about her sense of purpose and the person she's been raised to be. And hopefully that is where we are heading over the next several weeks.
Yeah, at some point she's going to have to figure out that the Rain side of her personality is dominating her non-Rain half of her personality. So that's going to – and I'm sure Ruby's going to play a factor in that. So that was that. Now, on Tuesday night, the Flash picks us up where – we left off, which is Barry has gone to prison. He is locked up in prison, and he's trying to adjust to life there. You know, he's not happy. Obviously, he wants to get out, but in the meantime, Axel, aka the Trickster, breaks out of prison with the help of his mother, Prank. You may remember that Mark Hamill played the original Trickster last year, the father of this Trickster. He's not in this episode, but the heretofore unmentioned mother, who was known as Prank, is here, and she rescues Trickster from prison, and Trickster decides he wants to impress his dad by taking down a hero, a costumed hero. Well, with the Flash not around right now, the only costumed hero making waves is Ralph as the heretofore unnamed until the end of the episode, Elongated Man, as Ralph Dibny is going around saving people and getting extremely overconfident in the process. It leads to a great battle between Trickster and Ralph, where Ralph experiences pain for the first time since his transformation, and it creates intense fear in him, as Ralph has never been known to be the bravest of souls. So we get some great interactions there with the whole team and Ralph. Meanwhile, in jail, what do you know? A crossover of our interests, Nick, as Barry Allen befriends his father's old cellmate known as Big Sur, who is a character from the comics played by Bill Goldberg of WCW and WWE fame. And they forge an alliance, a partnership of sorts. Not really a partnership, but they just get to know each other a little bit. And Big Sur actually saves Barry from a beatdown.
I am looking at a photo, a drawing of Big Sur from the comics on the Wikipedia page right now, and he looks not unlike a giant white mushmouth. It's remarkable.
I have to see this now.
His full name is Doofus P. Ratchet.
Yeah, see, intelligently on The Flash, they call him Dave Ratchet.
Ah, why didn't they go with Doofus?
Oh my god, he does look like a giant mushmouth.
He really does.
Doofus P. Ratchet, what a name. So, Big Sur, or Doofus, as we'll call him from here on out, played by Goldberg, you know, saves Barry from a prison beatdown. And as a result, they form an unlikely bond as Barry realizes that Big Sur, despite being a Big Sur, is not all that bad, and or so it seems. So that's going on in the prison. Ralph has to muster up the courage to rescue Killer Frost and Vibe from the clutches of the trickster and his increasingly insane mother, who says at one point that she's gone off her meds, and it shows. And Ralph, of course, finds that courage, finds a new suit in the process, and officially becomes the Elongated Man. I think the name of the episode actually is The Elongated Man Rises.
The Elongated Night Rises.
Night Rises, there we go. I have to say, Nick, I thought it was a really good episode.
I thought it was okay. I liked all the Ralph stuff. And I thought Barry and Goldberg, of course, had a pretty interesting subplot. But I thought the trickster and his mom were a tough watch for most of this episode. And I would like to make a motion that there are no more trickster episodes unless Mark Hamill's going to come back and do it.
Would second that motion. I thought the mom was good. I thought young trickster guy was awful.
Awful, just the worst. Yes,
like just cartoonishly bad. Which I know is the idea was to be cartoonish. But he was just bad. Like, he was like, God, I don't even know. He was like, I can't even think of a comparable. He was like a Gotham villain bad. I didn't like him either.
Which we'll talk about the, you know, how bad Gotham and people associated with it are in just a little bit.
That's right. So I thought, but I thought the episode was good. I thought all the Ralph stuff was great. Thought Barry and Big Sur's storyline was good. And of course, I thought it was shocking when Goldberg speared and jackhammered, of course, the Thinker instantly, ending the episode.
Yes, and then that, of course, brought rise to the new villain, the Stinker.
who Goldberg is going to actually wrestle at WrestleMania this year in a rare crossover between film and wrestling that hasn't been seen since 1989's No Holds Barred pay-per-view event.
Yeah.
You remember that, Nick?
Vaguely, yes.
In any event, we're going to move on now to Black Lightning, which hit us with episode Q on last week. And I honestly, Nick, because I've watched the third episode already, I'm going to need you to take over for me on this one and refresh me on what happens in the second episode.
The second episode deals largely with a former student of Jefferson's coming forward and saying that her daughter has been also taken prisoner, much like Jefferson's daughters were in the first episode. And so it's mostly about the fallout from that, him trying to deal with both the idea that the 100 gang has been bold enough to, you know, directly abduct girls from school property, and then also that they are continuing to operate out of the Seahorse Motel despite the actions Black Lightning took in episode one, just kind of directly continuing that. We get to see a little bit more of the disagreements between he and his ex-wife, where they reveal that his ex-wife legitimately believes that he is addicted to crime fighting, that he is addicted to his dual persona as Black Lightning, addicted to using his power, and that is part of the reason she doesn't want him to go back out there, is because she feels like his addiction is going to lead to him being, you know, killed at some point.
His addiction could lead to a broken condition.
Yes. So that's kind of what it's about. And I got to say, once again, it was fucking awesome.
Oh, it was amazing. It was so good. The way that they handle the the duality of Jefferson and his struggle with himself and with his wife, the way that they handle Lala in the episode, who was great as a villain.
Which I gotta say, that was one thing I did not approve of, was how the episode ended up for Lala, put it that way.
I will say I had my concerns about it, but ultimately I was worried it would be a Luke Cage situation, and after watching the third episode, I'm no longer worried about that. And I'll leave it at that. But yes, Lala was great and as a villain. Not great. He was one of the most hateable characters on television. In fact, but I have to say, I kind of agree with you on this term. I really want Jefferson to get his hands on Lala. And so, yes, there's a disappointment in that regard, because I wanted Black Lightning to be the one to put him down eventually. But
I also want him to tell his ex-wife to hit the bricks and don't let the door hit her in the ass on the way out.
You don't like when any character questions the lead character's motives, do you?
Well, when the motivations of Black Lightning are literally to protect his family and his community, no, I don't really approve of that.
You didn't. I bet you didn't like it. I bet you didn't like it when people questioned Backlund's motives.
Now wait just a minute. You know, that's different. In wrestling, you have to remember, Greg, it's always best to question people's motives.
That's true. That's a great point. And with that, you win the argument, sir. But no, this is a great episode. And I have to point this out before we move on. Maybe my favorite scene of the entire show to this point was his impassioned speech to his ex-wife about why he's Black Lightning now. When he finds out that his friend has been brutally murdered, as she was trying to get surveillance footage of her son, and she gets just killed in cold blood by Lala, his emotional reaction to that and his fiery speech to his wife was incredible. I had chills watching that scene. So good.
Yeah, absolutely a great scene.
Then Thursday night brings us to Arrow, and what I thought was a really nice bounce back for a show that's been in a bit of a lull for, gosh, probably three or four episodes now. And this episode brought us, brought William back into the fold, a welcome.
Finally, yeah.
Of William back into the fold as over the course of the episode, he finds out that Oliver has been lying to him and that he has been the Green Arrow since Diggle's injury. We also pick up the thread from the previous episode of the team being split down the middle, of Oliver, Felicity, and Diggle doing their thing, while Dinah and Curtis and Renee are doing their thing. And shockingly, I did not even hate the new team in this episode, because I thought they actually were their footage was limited. We didn't spend a whole lot of time on them. And B, the time that was spent on them furthered the plot and or did have some funny lines in it. Curtis actually landing some jokes for a change, which hasn't happened, I feel like, all season.
Well, and it didn't have them, you know, constantly being butthurt over what had happened with Oliver. Like, the more they dwell on the separation, and the worse it is, because it just reiterates to the audience just how wrong the three of them are. So the less they reference it at this point, the better.
Exactly. And the only thing that I'll say about that is that Dinah needs to learn the definition of the word consensus, because I don't think it means what she thinks it means. But in any event, I thought all that was good. We finally learn more about the plot or the plan of Caden James. We learn more about what he's wanting to do. He's shutting down the city, and he's planning to bankrupt Star City under the watch of Oliver Queen as a revenge for Oliver, in his words, killing his son. He claims that Oliver missed a shot during a fight the year before, and the stray arrow ended up killing Caden James' son, which set off this entire course of events. As it turns out, we learn that a mystery benefactor sent this supposedly irrefutable proof that the Green Arrow killed Caden James' son to him in a package. The problem is, Oliver could not have killed his son because at that time, Oliver was in Hub City looking for Dinah when he was trying to find a new Black Canary. So now the team's trying to prove that in addition to trying to stop Caden James's plans. We get a great, great heart-to-heart between Oliver, Felicity, and William that is one of the best scenes of the season at this point as far as emotional resonance goes. Just a great scene between them, and William's line about, you know, I used to worry about being an orphan, but now I have Felicity, was a powerful line and a great line. And I thought Felicity was spectacular in this episode, particularly when she was talking about trying to explain to Oliver what she had done to get this information. And she says, and it was kind of cool. And just a great run as Oliver is just nodding and clearly not paying any attention to anything she's saying and just waiting for her to get to the point. Great stuff. Really good episode, I thought. I enjoyed the hell out of it.
Yeah, a pretty big bounce back from what was, we both agreed, a fairly lackluster return from the midseason break. So glad to see him trending in the right direction again. Glad to see them continuing, finally, the William subplot and seeming to pick up a little momentum in that area. And now intrigued also by the possibility that perhaps Caden James is not the big bad of this season after all. Maybe there's a big reveal coming down the road, and, you know, I
was going to give you a chance, Nick. We haven't even talked about this, I'm going to go ahead and give you a chance, Nick. What do you think this – who do you think might be the secret main villain of the season? Somebody that might be real puppeteer behind everything.
I am going to go – you know, I think there's a chance this could be Tommy Merlin.
There you have it, folks. The yearly Nick Duke Tommy Merlin prediction. Actually, at this point, the semi-yearly Nick Duke Tommy Merlin prediction right here on the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Will it come true? I certainly hope so, because if it doesn't, I'm going to continue to hear this every season until the end of Arrow. So... but nonetheless, I actually do really hope that's true. That I thought the same thing, Nick, as I was watching the episode. I was like, now wait just a minute. Arrow? Who else would be firing an arrow? Perhaps an archer of some kind. An archer that doesn't like the light. Anyway, time to rank them. Rack them. And you want to go first or should I?
Well, it doesn't matter. Whatever you want to do.
I'll go first this week, and I'll rank them number one, Black Lightning,
mm-hmm.
number two, Arrow,
mm-hmm.
number three, Supergirl, and number four, The Flash.
The exact same rankings once again. Not really that hard for me. Black Lightning was by far the best. I thought Flash was a good bit behind the others, and I thought Arrow was a damn good episode in its own right, so... they fall pretty naturally into that same order of Black Lightning, Arrow, Supergirl, Flash for me.
Agreed. So, with that being said, it's time for us to move on to our weekly look at the news and notes in the comic book world, a segment we likes to call...
I reckon here's the rundown.
Welcome to the...
And the first bit of news here in the rundown, Nick, and by the way, we should tell people this is covering 2 weeks worth of news because we didn't actually do this segment last week.
No, we did not.
We're going to do it tonight.
We are.
And the first bit of news here is that Wally West, Kid Flash, is moving from The Flash onto Legends of Tomorrow. This, of course, pertains to the CWDC universe. And I think this is a great move, Nick. This is something that's going to allow Wally to appear unique. It's going to allow him to have more character development. Every character on Legends of Tomorrow has enjoyed more character development since they've gotten on that show. I don't think he'll be any different. And most importantly, it's going to add a dynamic to the team of legends that we haven't seen yet. We've never seen a speedster on the team, and it's going to give him a different use in battle. It's going to give him to give them something else visually to work with, and give him a chance to grow as a character and an actor moving forward. So I don't see any negatives to this.
Yeah, I mean, almost exactly like you said, all those reasons you listed, it's a great move. You and I both have talked about how there for a long time, it felt like the writers over on The Flash didn't really have a clue what to do with Wally. Once he had his powers, it kind of felt like that was the point at which they became less interested by him. We really didn't see much of him as Kid Flash playing a very active role in ongoing events. And this season has been, he's largely been MIA. So hopefully, you know, we will get to see a little bit more of him. And like you said, get to see that character develop a little bit over here on Legends. I think it's a good move for all parties involved.
Agreed completely. And it does, hopefully it will also answer a question I've had these last few weeks, Nick, which is while Barry's in prison, where the hell is Wally? Why isn't Wally like coming to help Star City when they need a hero?
The implication I get is that he's still, you know, in moping over his breakup with Jesse Quick.
But he did return for that one episode. Remember before the break?
Yes. Quite random when he returned and then departed once more.
Well, while we're excited about Wally going to Legends,
oh boy,
there's another bit of television news related to superheroes that came out this week that is less exciting. Unless you're a fan of the TV show Gotham.
And you shouldn't be if you are.
And let me tell you ahead of time that the concept of this show actually sounds good. Sounds like it could work. But when you hear who's attached, all hope will be lost. You see, the announcement was made that, as everybody knows, the DC streaming service is set to launch this year. And in 2019, a brand new live-action television show will be added to that DC online streaming service. And that show will be titled Metropolis. And it will star the characters of Lois Lane and Lex Luthor. Mr. Luthor, Lois Lane and Lex Luthor, and it's going to be set prior to the arrival of Superman, and will investigate the world of fringe science and expose the city's dark and bizarre secrets. So not exactly the premise that Nick and I have bandied about of a journalism show about Metropolis, about the Daily Planet, but perhaps something, you know, that could still play into that a little bit, and the building of Lex's criminal empire, assumingly. However, here's the downside, folks. The show will be produced by Gotham's John Stevens and Danny Cannon.
Boo. Hashtag Gotham sucks.
So what I'm saying is you can expect lots of extremely on-the-nose dialogue.
Yes.
Characterizations that only have a very basic understanding of the characters that they're trying to reproduce.
Yes. The entirety of Superman's Rogues Gallery to be created as a result of the actions of Lex Luthor and Lois Lane years before Superman ever actually appears, and Superman's entire Rogues Gallery to have their eventual supervillain name in their actual name.
Yes. What are some examples that people might run into, Nick?
Oh, I think you'll see John Metallo. I think you'll see a German-born Dom's Day probably moving over. I think, and of course, you know, let's not forget wealthy socialite Paris Eyte. You know, I think there's you know, different possibilities all around.
Yes, that's true, and of course, the main villain of season one, they'll want to keep it very grounded. So the main villain of season one will be the recurring mob boss, Frederick Intergang.
Ah, yes, Frederick Intergang is one of my favorites.
But yeah, and of course, you can also expect the show, most importantly, to suck.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Now then again, though, Greg, here's the thing. If it takes, you know, a tonal cue from Gotham, they'll reach back into the old Superman movies, the old Donner movies, and mishmash the time of the 1970s with modern technology. And because it will have moments where it looks like a Donner movie, there's a healthy subset of the Superman population that will instantly think it's awesome.
Absolutely. My God, it's the same typewriter they used in Richard Donner's Superman. Five stars.
Five stars. Man of Steel sucks.
2.5 stars. three stars. Whatever, but nonetheless.
Whoa, now let's not. 3 stars is pretty lofty, Greg.
That is, you're right. But no, the show is not going to be good in all likelihood. I hope it is. I hope I'm wrong, but there's no reason for me to believe that it's going to be good. So let's take a big old all over that and move on to the next topic. What is that next topic? Well, I'm glad you asked myself.
Tonight,
the topic is Scott Snyder's next big DC Comics assignment. And in somewhat of a surprise, I think, Nick, because I certainly didn't see this coming, an entirely new family of Justice League titles will launch following the conclusion of the current and somewhat convoluted Dark Knights Metal event in March, starting with a weekly 4-issue series titled Justice League No Justice. And that will be written by Scott Snyder, Josh Williamson, and James Tynion IV, with art by Francis Manapul. And after that, I guess, is this true, Nick, that after that, Scott Snyder is taking over? Yeah, after the conclusion of No Justice, Scott Snyder will take over the writing duties on Justice League, while Tynion and Williamson will pen spinoff series of Justice League. And there are more spinoffs yet to be named. No artist or release dates on Snyder's Justice League, but Scott Snyder as the architect of Justice League. Your thoughts?
Yeah, this is very exciting for sure. Did they reveal who's no artist announced for Snyder's Justice League book? But no, that's a really cool idea. I think we've talked for a while about how Justice League really should be the flagship title of DC Comics, and what better way to get it back on the path to being that than by putting your preeminent monthly comic book writer on the book. I think it's very exciting, and I think it provides some interesting opportunities, because it sounds to me like this No Justice thing is gonna feature, all these different characters coming together, even those that are outside the, quote, main Justice League team. And then I would imagine that these spinoff series will actually see, the teams kind of shaken up a bit, and see the lineups shaken up and the rosters changed up a little bit. And so I think that's going to be just a positive, change for everyone. I love the Core 8 team, the world's mightiest heroes and all that, to borrow a phrase from Marvel. But Justice League has always featured roster shakeup as a part of its central tenet. So I am excited to see what Snyder's going to do with a team entirely of his own making. And I would have to assume that will include Bruce Wayne for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, the interesting thing is in this No Justice series, the basic plot is that Brainiac comes and warns the heroes of an impending threat that will destroy the multiverse if they don't stop it or whatever. And so, or destroy Earth anyway. So the heroes have to go to these 4 different planets to stop this impending threat. And they divide up into 4 different Strike Force teams, each one with Tito Santana and Rick Martel attached from various parts of the multiverse. But the teams are pretty interesting, Nick, in this No Justice series. It's a mix of heroes and villains on the team. And so one, you have Superman, Martian Manhunter, Sinestro, Starro, and Starfire. In another one, you have Batman, Deathstroke, Lex Luthor, Lobo, and I can't make out that last
one. I believe that's Metamorpho, but I'm not 100% sure.
And then in the other team, you have Wonder Woman, Zatanna, Dr. Fate, Raven, and Etrigan the Demon, which is an interesting lineup of characters, to be sure. And then finally, you have the Flash, the Atom, Robin, Harley Quinn, and Cyborg.
This is interesting for sure.
So there you have it. Moving on from that, we also got an announcement a few weeks ago about the official creator lineup, at least to this point, for Action Comics number 1000. This iconic story that's going to be coming our way April 18th. First of all, Superman is getting his red trunks back on the cover. We don't know if that will carry through to the interiors or not, but I think it will from what I'm reading. Unimportant overall. Now, here's what's important. This creative lineup. You've got the writers of the two current Superman books, Superman Action Comics, will each have 15-page stories in Action 1000. Dan Jurgens will write and draw his story, which I'm super excited for because I love Dan Jurgens drawing Superman. While Pat Gleason is drawing a story by his co-writer, Peter J. Tomasi. Meanwhile, Brian Michael Bendis will be writing a 10-page story in Action 1000 drawn by Jim Lee. Talk about a freaking power couple, right?
Absolutely.
This will be Bendis' first DC work since 2000's Batman Chronicles number 21. And here is where the slam dunk is made. Additional stories are planned from the teams of Richard Donner, Jeff Johns, and Olivier Coipel, Paul Denny and Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, Tom King and Clay Mann, and Jordy Belair, Brad Meltzer, John Cassidy, and Laura Martin, Louise Simonson and Jerry Ordway, Scott Snyder and Tim Sale, and Marv Wolfman and freaking Kurt Swan, the late great Kurt Swan, based on unpublished art. I mean, that's instantly the best lineup of creative talents in the history of DC Comics, is it not?
I mean, for something like this, you know, a lot of times when they do these approaches where it's multiple little anthology stories in one larger comic, they do a pretty even mix of known creators and new faces. And this is just all the big guns being pulled out. And it says here in the story that even more stories and all-star collaborations are said to be announced at a later date. So this is just going to be an absolutely monumental moment for DC Comics, and the expectations for this book are now officially through the roof. I, for one, can't wait to see what this winds up being.
Yeah, I mean, I look at this list, and it's for anyone, especially for someone like me, that's loved Superman since he was 4 years old. You know, this is just incredible to see this. The people from my youth, whether it's Dan Jurgens, Louise Simonson, Jerry Ordway, seeing them involved in this. But to see people that have had such an impact on the Man of Steel over the years, whether it's Paul Denny, whose animated series work was so vital to the character, Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, who drew an iconic Superman in the 70s, in the Bronze Age, Richard Donner and Jeff Johns, who wrote that great Action Comics run in the mid-2000s, and also, of course, Donner's work with him in the film speaks for itself. Brad Meltzer, who did great work on Superman and Justice League in the past, Scott Snyder and Tim Sale. Good Lord, that speaks for itself. And then, of course, probably the most identified with the character artist of them all, Kurt Swan. Just an incredible lineup of talent.
Absolutely, and it makes me really, really want a Scott Snyder and Tim Sale collaboration to be a more long-lasting thing. Would love to see those two do a Batman story together, even if Snyder's time writing that character solo it seems to be coming to an end.
Indeed. And speaking of times with characters coming to an end, what better way to transition into a topic that I'm really going to let Nick speak on, and that is an announcement from longtime Amazing Spider-Man writer Dan Slott, who announced that he is departing Amazing Spider-Man as of issue number 801, a decision he says has been in the making for years. He's been the writer on this title since 2008.
The average traveler visits loads of different websites
and took over soul writing duties in 2010. And he is leaving Spider-Man to move over to Invincible Iron Man, a character that he is inheriting from Brian Michael Bendis. So, Nick, I'm just going to let you go.
Well, bye.
That's all you got?
Fuck him. Glad he's gone. You know.
Good night.
Yeah, it has been shitty concept after shitty concept for what feels like a decade now, complete with, you know, him still being butthurt over the online reception he got in the wake of the launch of Superior Spider-Man, and he turned that into one of the most blatant online troll personas in all of comic book writing, which covers a lot of ground considering Mark Waid is still alive. So, you know, it's one of those things that just I'm glad to see him go. I hope he fails miserably on Iron Man, but then again, I hope he does very well on Iron Man. So, because maybe he'll stay over there for 10 years and not try to ruin any other Marvel characters that I love and care about. So, goodbye, Dan Slott. Don't let the door hit you in your no talented ass on the way out.
Good Lord, Nick, swinging hard here. An unwarranted shot at Mark Waid, too. Man.
Not a shot at Mark Waid, but a shot at Mark Waid's online persona, which we all can agree is a bit testy at times.
Well.
Oh, you're not gonna agree with that, even though you agree with it off air. Stop straddling the fence, Greg. Have a take.
I shan't say any more. What I will say is I'm happy for those fans of Spider-Man who are happy for this move. It's a move that some would say should have happened long ago. I am not at liberty to say such a thing, as I don't regularly read Spider-Man.
And count me as officially being in favor of the rumored idea of Nick Spencer taking over the title. I am for it.
No. You mean Nick Spencer.
Well,
right?
If that's how we're going to
asterisks in his name.
That's true. But if that's the case, however we're referring to him now, if that is the ultimate choice or the choice for the title, I am in favor of that. I've liked most of the guy's Marvel work that I've read, reactions to Secret Empire aside. So, hope that winds up being the case, and very much looking forward to possibly being able to be a monthly reader of Spider-Man once more.
Very good. So let's get to the Oscars. The nominations came out, and Nick and I were on the record that we didn't think any of the major categories would have a comic book film nominated for it. Well, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 landed a visual effects nomination. But that's, you know, that's not a major category. That's one that comic book movies, you know, have been in the running for before. But here's the big one. What's considered one of the biggest categories at the Oscars is adapted screenplay. And Logan earned a nomination for writers Scott Frank, James Mangold, and Michael Green. They are competing against Call Me By Your Name, The Disaster Artist, Molly's Game, and Mudbound. And Nick, well-deserved nomination here for Logan.
Yeah, I would totally agree. I had held out some outside hope that perhaps Patrick Stewart could earn at least a nomination for supporting actor, even though I knew the chances were slim. I know there were various other categories that I think Logan absolutely deserved to be nominated for. But, you know, adapted screenplay was one I hadn't really given a lot of consideration to, and when this came out, it caught me completely by surprise, but I am thrilled they chose to acknowledge this. It was a tour de force in superhero storytelling in a completely different subgenre.
Genre.
I am thrilled that it is being recognized. And also, we should throw a little bit of a shout out, not a major award, you know, because comic book movies are nominated for these types of awards all the time. But Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 was a visual effects nominee as well. So congrats to both Logan and Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 for being nominated for the highest awards in their field.
As I mentioned before, I talked about Logan.
Well, fair enough.
but yes, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 was awesome as well. But Logan is a movie that I think, you know, in a perfect world, deserves more nominations for sure. But we'll take this, man. This is a big breakthrough for comic book films, because it's been since The Dark Knight since any of the major categories have received any nominations. And that was for supporting actor. This is for adapted screenplay. Now, if we could have one where maybe a season comes along and gets more than one of the categories, that would be great. Very excited about that. But the last thing we're going to leave you with here this week is our thoughts, our reaction on the release of the first trailer for the Ant-Man sequel, Ant-Man and the Wasp. Just watched this this morning, I think, or maybe yesterday. No, last night, actually, is when I watched it. Nick, your thoughts on the trailer?
Oh, great. I was very impressed by what I saw. And Marvel has just got the art of the trailer down to an exact science at this point. It is remarkable how great their trailers are, and this was no exception. Getting to see glimpses of Michael Douglas, getting to see Evangeline Lilly finally in action as the Wasp, getting to see kind of the story of the film, how it's going to be directly related to the events of Captain America Civil War, which makes me happy. I was worried they were just kind of, you know, sweep that under the rug somehow, but looks like Scott and Hank and Janet are all going to be, or Hope, excuse me, are all going to be fugitives on the run from the government who are seeking to close in on Scott after his role that he played on the pro-Cap side of things in Civil War. So, yeah, I'm very excited about this. Had some great visual gags, some great, action sequences from what we could see, and a distinct lack of Michael Pena. So, good things all around in this trailer.
I want more Michael Pena.
I'm aware that you do, and I want less. So I'm good with this trailer.
There is our impasse. But nevertheless, I love the trailer. I thought it was awesome.
Yes.
Yes, it could have used more Michael Pena, but everything could.
No.
But the trailer itself was phenomenal. The action sequences were so creative and so cool. That freaking thing where they shrink the van and it goes underneath the other van and then embiggens and knocks the existing van up in the air.
Is that what we're calling it now, embiggening?
I will not spoil any of this week's CW shows.
Ah, I got you.
But it's also a Simpsons reference. The spirit, what is it? The spirit of the noble man embiggens even the smallest heart.
I loved the bit with Hank shrinking the building and then picking it up and rolling it along like a piece of luggage. I thought that was remarkable, personally.
Oh, that was great. The Pez dispenser.
Yes.
Totally marked out for the Pez dispenser. It looks awesome. It was such a great trailer, such a fun movie. Ant-Man's one that I think holds up really well anyway, and better than a lot of the other movies, in fact, in terms of age. And I think this is one that looks like it's going to improve on everything from the original. And I think I saw this bandied about, but I like the idea of not even having a quote-unquote villain in the movie. In other words, maybe this being sort of the MCU version of The Fugitive, where the villain, I guess, quote-unquote, is Tommy Lee Jones, but he's really just a dude doing his job trying to capture Harrison Ford.
Well,
not the character Harrison Ford was playing, but Harrison Ford.
Apparently, we didn't see much of the villain in the trailer, but from what I've been reading, the film will have a villain, and it will be the lesser-known MCU or Marvel character, Ghost, who is primarily an Iron Man villain. So we'll see what role that character winds up playing. But I do believe it's a female villain, which should be interesting.
Yes, and I like the on-the-run aspect and the ways they can play with that. So should be a fun movie. Well, that brings us to the end of our journey this week. Our long book hunt is over. Our reading and watching is done. Our rundown is completed. Nick, what do we have coming the folks' way next week?
Next week, we're going to continue Black Panther Month by taking a very special look at the short-lived BET animated series Black Panther, which I have heard lives in infamy, but we will make up our minds for ourselves when we take a look at that. So be here next week for that, and then the following week we will, of course, have our special feature-length review of the Black Panther theatrical film, and then wrapping it all up with an unprecedented second long book hunt of the month, this time bringing it more into the present day era by looking at taking a look at the first volume of the most recent Black Panther run by famed author Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Excellent news all around. Should make for some interesting shows, and I understand there are rumblings, Nick, that some happenings are afoot. I understand that Jim Ross has been contacted by our representatives for a project we're working on for the near future. Larry King and then some other celebrities have also been contacted. Even the late, great Stu Hart.
The late, great Stu Hart. Dusty.
Disturbed in his chamber.
Dusty Rhodes, Skip Carey as well. Let's not forget that.
Skip Carey. And from what I'm fairly certain will be Carl Childers as well.
Yes, I'm fairly sure of that. At some point, we'll have to see Carl Childers. Just a variety of you know, celebrities and Place to Be Nation personalities who are banding together for the second installment. Talks. Of Place to Be Nation Pop Comic Book Theater, as we originally announced back at the end of 2017. We are making progress on that. I can't tell you how much progress at the moment, but work has begun, and keep your ears pressed to your electronic devices. I was going to say the ground, but that just wouldn't make any sense.
What's important here is that the visionaries are at work. Mm-hmm. We are crafting our baby. We are reaching out to the right personnel. We're casting, and not casting aspersions, but casting. And then there's another bit of word on the street I got, Nick, and that is that further down the line, the early rumblings I've gotten
in the last week,
my pager has been going off. I've been getting pages and beeps.
Please no.
From Adam Schefter.
Oh God!
From Tim Kirkchen, I've been getting burps. I've been getting burps from Peter Gammons. I got contacted just the other day by Todd McShay, and I don't know if this is actually him. But this is just the name that popped up on my page was Mel Kiper Jr. He didn't even say anything. He just said Mel Kiper Jr. So I don't know what that means, but I've heard that there may be a draft coming through the area somewhere towards the summer and fall of this year. So I don't know. I mean, we'll keep you updated, nation, as to what the ramifications of this are. We don't know what this means. You know, there's just all kinds of stuff going on. Nick, you certainly didn't seem to react too fondly to that news.
The Place to Be Nation Pop comic book draft is a time-honored tradition in this business. And as we all know, Greg, individuals have different responses to said time-honored traditions. And, it can't be any worse than the last one. Let's put it that way.
That's right, and it is a biennial tradition, I would remind everyone out there.
Yes.
That's right. Only once every 2 years.
2 years.
Which is one of our better recurring gags, I have to say.
Thank you.
But
isn't it remarkable that we've been around long enough for this to be the third biennial Peter David Memorial Place to Be Nation Pop comic book draft presented by a hypothetical online unlimited DC comic subscription service?
Yes. Yes, I feel like we should have some sort of an anniversary celebration coming up at some point, but I don't know if that's true or not.
You don't do that until you get to the fifth, and then that would have been 10 years of the Place to Be Nation Pop comic book draft, which is even more terrifying. That seems like a possibility.
Oh my!
Speaking of anniversaries, Greg, you know you and I are rapidly approaching the 2 year anniversary of this very podcast.
We're gonna have to bring it in style, Nick.
Rapidly approaching both the 2 year anniversary and our landmark 100th episode.
Ooh, and you know that's going to be a big one. And by a big one, I mean probably exactly the same size as all our other episodes.
Yes, that is the plan.
But you never know who we might reach out to. We're gonna try to spice things up for our big anniversary shows. So stay tuned for that. And in the meantime,
how self-indulgent would it be to have a 100th episode special and then 4 episodes later have a 2-year anniversary special?
Just self-indulgent enough to be appropriate for us.
Gotcha.
And that brings me to my lightning round question.
Oh, boy.
And this is going to be a pretty easy one, I think. But then again, it could be difficult.
Okay.
Now, the question is, what show on Place to Be Nation Pop is the longest running weekly episodic comic book broadcast?
Do we have any broadcasts?
Podcasts.
Longest running weekly episodic podcast. That's the Place to Be Nation mothership, right?
Right. Longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast, though.
Oh, that's us. That's the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
You got it. It is us. And you know what your reward is, Nick? The same as my reward.
Absolutely nothing.
Absolutely nothing. A continued extra few days on this relentlessly depressing mortal coil.
Mm-hmm.
And on that note, we invite you to join us all next week for another rousing edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
Hard Traveling Fanboys. Hard Traveling Fanboys. Hard Traveling Fanboys. Hard Traveling Fanboys. Hard Traveling Fanboys. Hard Traveling Fanboys. Hard Traveling Fanboys. Hard Traveling Fanboys. Hard Traveling Fanboys. Hard Traveling Fanboys. Hard Traveling Fanboys. Hard Traveling Fanboys. Hard Traveling Fanboys. Hard Traveling Fanboys.
Sorry I had a fight in the middle of your Black Panther party.